Chapter 11. Do You Fear God's Justice? By Brad Cole. Sadly, there are those who would have us love Christ for protecting us from God, instead of leading us to God, the one home of safety. They imagine justice and love dwelling in eternal opposition in the bosom of eternal unity. George MacDonald. Several years ago, I was asked to give a lecture on the subject of God's love for sinners. The stories I chose to illustrate this point included Jesus' treatment of the woman caught in adultery, his forgiveness toward Peter, and his act of washing the feet of Judas in the upper room. At the conclusion, a man in the audience rose to add something that he felt was missing. "It's true that God is love, but don't forget God's justice. If God is infinitely loving, He must also be infinitely just. He must punish sin." What is God's justice? Is it in some way separate and distinct from His love? Should we view the character of God like a two-sided coin, one full of love and mercy, while the other is best defined as justice? I recently came across the following quote that expresses a common sentiment about God's justice. "God is love. But God also punishes the sinner and hates all who do iniquity." God is not one-sided. He is not simply an infinitely loving God. He is also infinitely just. He must deal with sin. He must punish the sinner. Many Christians today have come to equate God's justice with being part of a legal framework that involves punishment for sin. We naturally tend to associate justice with our own criminal, legal system. Our contemporary society uses the slogan, "You do the crime, you do the time." This implies that if you do the time, you've paid your debt to society and justice has been satisfied. For example, when George W. Bush said, "We will bring the terrorists to justice," the meaning was clear to everyone that they would be punished appropriately for their crimes. But this understanding of the word justice does not represent the biblical meaning of justice and limits it to a legal offense that deserves an appropriate punishment. Centuries of reading the Bible through the culturally dominant lens of punitive justice are hard to shake off. We read the word justice in our Bibles and simply assume that it is referring to punitive justice. God's justice in the Old Testament. As we turn to the Old Testament, God's justice is described in a very different frame of reference than that of our modern legal judicial system. To our surprise, we find that God's justice is something that we would actually like to be on the receiving end of. For example, notice to whom God administers justice in this verse. "Defend the poor and fatherless. Do justice, tzedak, to the afflicted and needy." Here, the psalmist is obviously not suggesting that the afflicted and needy should be punished. Rather, his command is that we should help them. Justice, in this verse, refers to the actions of mercy and love. The two main Hebrew words for justice are tzedak, or tzedakah, and mishpat, or mishpat. By the context of how these words are used, let's try to build a picture of the Hebrew concept of God's justice. "Wash yourselves clean. Stop all this evil that I see you doing. Yes, stop doing evil and learn to do right. See that justice, mishpat, is done. Help those who are oppressed. Give orphans their rights and defend widows." The justice involved here is to do good to the outcasts of society by correcting the injustice that has been done to them. In fact, we will notice as a theme all the way through that God is not the one who uses violence when he administers justice. Rather, God's justice is to compassionately intervene against the violent actions done by others. "This is what the Lord says to the dynasty of David. Give justice, mishpat, each morning to the people you judge. Help those who have been robbed. Rescue them from their oppressors." God's justice is ultimately to do what is right and to make things right by exercising compassion toward those who have been treated unfairly. The Lord is waiting to be kind to you. He rises to have compassion on you. The Lord is a God of justice. Mishpat. Thus says the Lord God, enough, O princes of Israel. Remove violence and plundering. Execute justice, Mishpat, and righteousness, Tzadak, and stop dispossessing my people, says the Lord God. You shall have honest scales. God's justice is to make things right by stopping violence, rather than by executing violence on others. Injustice is described as robbing, cheating, and mistreating people, while God's justice is to begin treating people in fairness, the way God would treat them. In this passage, justice, Mishpat, and righteousness, Tzadok, are used together. This occurrence is a frequent one in the Old Testament. The meaning does not contrast between righteous actions and just actions, but rather, these two words are complementary. Let's consider the context. Abraham and his family were commanded to do righteousness and justice. David administered justice and righteousness for all his people. Job put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. Of God, it is said, may he judge your people with righteousness and your poor with justice. And righteousness and justice are the foundation of your throne. Steadfast love and faithfulness go before you. None of these examples involve an externally imposed punishment. God's command to us is to act with justice and righteousness and deliver from the hand of the oppressor anyone who has been robbed, and do no wrong or violence to the alien, the orphan, and the widow, or shed innocent blood in this place. In countless examples, justice primarily involves the treatment of others, especially the poor, vulnerable, and outcasts of society. Jewish kings were commanded to practice mishpat u'tzedakah. The literal translation of this term is justice and righteousness, or justice and charity. Classical as well as modern commentators agree that this command does not refer to courtroom justice and charity, but to social justice. The major wrongdoing to which the prophets objected was not the perversion of the judicial process, but oppression and exploitation of the poor by the political elite and the wealthy classes. One modern political scientist wrote, "The execution of righteousness and justice in the royal domain refers primarily to acts on behalf of the poor and less fortunate classes of the people." This policy was implemented primarily by means of social legislation rather than by court judgments. The idea, or ideal, of social justice has a long history in Judaism. The Hebrew concept of justice, as manifested through acts of mercy and compassion toward the mistreated and outcasts of society, runs consistently throughout the entire Old Testament, beginning with the books of Moses. He executes justice, mishpat, for the orphan and the widow, and shows his love for the alien by giving him food and clothing. You shall not pervert the justice, mishpat, do an alien or an orphan, nor take a widow's garment in pledge. In the Old Testament, to bring justice does not mean to bring punishment, but to bring healing and reconciliation. Justice means to make things right by correcting injustice. Justice is ultimately an expression of mercy. It is God's mercy in action. This mercy is described as a path that we are to follow, a way of life. I walk the way of righteousness, Tzadok. I follow the paths of justice, Mishpat. This proverb is an example of Hebrew poetry, which is not based on rhyme, but on repetition, where the second line of the verse adds meaning and depth to the first line. The path of justice, then, is the way of righteousness. Said another way, the path of justice is the path of right doing in an unjust world. We are somewhat familiar with this kind of making right justice. When I justify my Word document, I am not punishing it, but rather aligning or making right the document. Throughout the Old Testament, we see God again and again calling his people to revolt against the self-promotional and often violent dog-eat-dog survival-of-the-fittest principle in which the stronger oppresses and feeds off the weaker. How are we to live in this world? What does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God? Justice is something that we do. True justice requires making things right by manifesting the love of God through acts of loving kindness and mercy. The Hebrew concept of justice is not lost in today's world. For Jewish people today, the word tzedak or tzedakah is still associated with acts of charity and loving restoration. A number of Jewish charities, for example, are in some form named after this Hebrew word. This is beautiful, and it harmonizes perfectly with the Old Testament concept of justice. Christianity, too, often emphasizes legal matters, such as getting the doctrines right, being in good legal standing with God, being covered with blood, and so on. A right conception of God's justice, however, leads us to see that how we treat people is the most important Christian obligation of all, because to do righteousness and justice is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice. So once again, how does the Old Testament define God's justice? This is what the Lord of armies says. Administer real justice, Mishpat. Be compassionate and kind to each other. God's justice is a compassionate, kind, and loving intervention in a world full of great injustice. What about punishment? Someone may be wondering at this point, isn't this a bit one-sided? What about punishment? The man who rebuked me with the words, God is love, but he is also just, went on to direct my attention to a long list of stories in the Bible, from the flood to Sodom and Gomorrah and the lake of fire. He said, look, there is the justice of God. God is punishing them. If God does not punish sin, he is not a God of justice. We need to realize that events such as the flood are a different subject from God's justice. According to the Old Testament, God does not punish for the sake of satisfying his justice. In fact, there is compelling evidence that none of these dramatic interventions were for the sake of punishment. For example, was the biblical flood a punishment sent by God? Here's how the Bible describes the setting for this event. Noah had no faults and was the only good man of his time. He lived in fellowship with God, but everyone else was evil in God's sight, and violence had spread everywhere. God looked at the world and saw that it was evil, for the people were all living evil lives. And a few verses later, the Lord said to Noah, go into the boat with your whole family. I have found that you are the only one in all the world who does what is right. Noah was the only good man of his generation. Noah was the only man left who had a true knowledge of God. Is the Bible accurate in this statement? Or is this exaggeration? Only one man? The statement must be accurate when we consider how many people got on that boat. If God had known that he had 10,000 friends during this time, wouldn't he have had Noah build hundreds of boats to accommodate all those who trusted Noah's warning? God knew that no one would respond. So, in mercy, he asked Noah to preach a message to plead with the people over a very long period of time. Anyone was welcome on that boat. The ark was God's means to prepare a way of safety. Now, imagine what would have happened had God prevented the flood. The last man with a real trusting relationship with God would have died, and the knowledge of God on earth would have been extinguished. Planet Earth would have lost contact with God entirely, and Satan would have won the cosmic conflict. We wouldn't even be here today if God had not allowed the flood to occur. All of the evidence that we have today about the kind of person God is, primarily based on Jesus' life and death on earth, had not yet been given. God rescued the last man, the last family, in order to preserve contact with planet Earth. The flood is not an example of God punishing sin, but rather an example of God stepping in to preserve his people and ultimately the human race. Sin does a fine job of punishing all on its own. God doesn't need to add to the pain. The flood became a rescue mission to save the last man with a true knowledge of God, rather than an act of retributive punishment. The story of Elisha and the bears is another example that makes us wonder if God is out to retributively punish for sin. Even though the prophet Elijah had just been taken up to heaven in spectacular chariots of fire, his successor, the prophet Elisha, received very little respect from the Israelites. Some youths came from the city and mocked him and said to him, "Go up, you bald head! Go up, you bald head!" So he turned around and looked at them and pronounced a curse on them in the name of the Lord. And two female bears came out of the woods and mauled 42 of the youths. Did God feel that those young people crossed the line and needed to be punished? Again, what was the setting? If we turn back just one chapter in this book, we find that the king of Israel, who was considered the spiritual leader of the people, had fallen off his balcony. In his pain, he consulted the god of Ekron rather than the god of Israel to see if he would survive. Even the king was worshiping other gods. These youths were aware of Elijah's spectacular translation into heaven, yet they remained completely unmoved by this event and even mocked Elijah's successor. "Hey, you go up with Elijah too, bald head." Once again, this is not an example of God punishing teenagers because they went too far. Rather, by allowing this severe incident to take place, God protected Israel by preserving the necessary respect for his prophet. Perhaps it's worth noting that Elisha was never threatened again, and God was able to use Elisha to do great miracles for his people in a dark world. Then there is the story of Uzzah touching the ark. Did God intervene because the severity of the sin required capital punishment? Was Uzzah's mistake of reaching out to steady the ark greater than that of a mass murderer? Here we see that God does not go around punishing people based on the severity of the sin. If he did, then child molesters, not Uzzah, would be dropping dead left and right. Rather, in love for his people, God desperately tried to get an important message to King David, who was given the charge to bring Israel closer to God. Indeed, David understood that the Ark of the Covenant, the symbol of God's power, was to be treated with respect and reverence. David had acted carelessly by not following the instructions God had laid out for transporting the ark. What effect did it have on the nation of Israel when they watched their king blatantly disregard God's commands? God's intervention was not designed to punish Uzzah. Rather, it was for the purpose of restoring respect for God in Israel. Without respect for God, the Israelites would have drifted away from God. Undoubtedly, stories such as this are some of the most difficult in the entire Bible. But there is consolation in the thought that one day God will resurrect Uzzah, who will have the same train of thought, character, and ability to respond to truth and evidence. Nowhere does it say that Uzzah will not be part of God's kingdom. That is between Uzzah and God. Sometimes we don't put all the pieces of a particular Bible story together, and therefore misinterpret it. For example, when we read that God punished Moses for striking the rock by not allowing him to enter the promised land, we may be inclined to paint a gloomy picture of God in our minds. All we would know of this story from reading the Old Testament is that God ended the life of his friend Moses, who, at the time of his death, was as strong as ever, and his eyesight was still good. From a limited perspective, it seems unfair. When we discover the rest of the story, however, we realize that God fought against Satan to resurrect Moses, and later gave Moses the great honor of encouraging Jesus prior to his crucifixion. For Uzzah, as well as for Moses, there is a rest of the story. The extreme examples of God's interventions in the Old Testament are not for the sake of punishment, but rather because of the desperate nature of the situation. Biblical stories such as this do not fit under the umbrella definition of God's justice. God was just in the sense that he did the right thing. But these crisis interventions are not what the Bible is referring to when it talks about God's justice. Justice that does involve punishment. Still, there is a discipline from God, sometimes referred to as a punishment, that any parent can identify with. When one's 13-year-old son is misusing the internet, a loving parent may punish by taking away internet privileges for a period of time. This does not represent a retributive action, merely for purpose of inflicting pain. Rather, it springs from the worthy motive of leading him in the right direction and away from danger. The purpose is for discipline and healing. Like a loving parent, God's actions are never retributive and simply for the sake of punishment. I will discipline you, but with justice. I cannot let you go unpunished. God's actions always spring from love and are for the purpose of healing and restoration. God's justice toward the outcasts of society at times involves actively preventing abuse to continue. This sometimes involves restraining evildoers in order to protect the innocent. Some have suggested, however, that mere restraint doesn't go far enough. If God does not painfully punish Hitler, child molesters, and rapists before executing them, he does not deserve my respect. This view, however, does not appreciate the intrinsic result of sin, which is pain, suffering, and death. When Hitler comes face to face with God someday, he will experience inestimable suffering. But this will be caused by the natural consequence of being completely out of harmony with God's character of love. No extrinsic penalty imposed by God will be necessary. God was apparently able to win the heart of wicked King Manasseh, who was somewhat of an ancient Hitler. Manasseh sacrificed his own son by fire, sawed the prophet Isaiah in half in a hollow log, and murdered many innocent people until Jerusalem was filled from one end to the other with innocent blood. Even though Manasseh repented prior to his death, he most certainly experienced much suffering in his conversion. How much more suffering will there be for a person like Hitler who chose to persist in his rebellion against God? Suffering? Yes. But not retributive on God's part. No legal balancing of ledgers or evening out the final score. Whereas the suffering involved in a reconciliation is almost infinitely intensified, it is never, when we stand inside the gospel, retributive suffering. Suffering there is in plenty. If a person has committed an offense, he cannot be restored to fellowship until he has accepted the pain of responsibility for his offense and, so far as possible, made reparation. Anything less would be a diminution of his personality. To demand less would not be grace, it would be insult. But his responsibility is not to some abstract system of justice. It is to God and to his fellow men. That, and nothing abstract or subpersonal, is the measure of his responsibility. On the side of the injured party, who ultimately is God himself, the suffering of forgiveness is boundless. This, too, is the cost involved in the structure of personal relationship as God has created it. But on both sides, the suffering is creative and restorative and healing, not in obedience to abstract laws of justice, but to the demands of the living organism of persons, which is most characteristically represented by the body of Christ. Sin pays the wage. Whether we are one to God's side, like Manasseh, or whether we remain hardened against God, sin leaves a punishing scar that carries its own inherent penalty. You have brought this on yourself by abandoning the Lord your God when he led you on his way. Your own wickedness will correct you, and your unfaithful ways will punish you. You should know and see how evil and bitter it is for you if you abandon the Lord your God. Judah, you have brought this on yourself by the way you have lived and by the things you have done. Your sin has caused this suffering. It has stabbed you through the heart. See how wicked people think up evil. They plan trouble and practice deception. But in the traps they set for others, they themselves get caught. So they are punished by their own evil and are hurt by their own violence. I thank the Lord for his justice. I sing praises to the Lord, the Most High. God describes even the final death of Satan as a destructive process that comes from within. You defiled your sanctuaries with your many sins in your dishonest trade. So I brought fire out from within you, and it consumed you. I reduced you to ashes on the ground in the sight of all who were watching. Our God is not like a stern judge who is waiting to inflict a painful sentence. He is instead more like a physician waiting to heal his sick patients who are infected with selfishness, pride, jealousy, and hate, as well as a host of other spiritual maladies. Imagine that you see a physician for a cough and fever. After examining you and running some tests, including maybe a chest x-ray, the doctor diagnoses you with pneumonia and informs you that antibiotics are necessary to cure this condition. Now, let's suppose you get home and refuse to take them. Does the doctor need to sneak into your home at night to worsen your pneumonia because he is angry with you? Or does the pneumonia do its own punishing? Similarly, if you refuse to brush your teeth, do offended dentists insert additional cavities into your teeth? Or did your lack of brushing directly cause the cavities? The Bible tells us that sin carries its own punishment and ultimately leads to death. For sin pays its wage, death. The biblical concept of God's justice has nothing to do with God adding on additional pain to settle the score. Eugene Peterson's The Message beautifully captures the meaning of Jesus' words. Don't pick on people, jump on their failures, criticize their faults, unless, of course, you want the same treatment. That critical spirit has a way of boomeranging. Lightning bolts don't come from heaven when we sin. Rather, sin boomerangs. Justice, Jesus' style. The Old Testament definition of God's justice as compassionate intervention in this world does not suddenly change in the New Testament. Unfortunately, we often fail to rely on the Old Testament as a basis for understanding God's justice in the New. Instead, we apply our modern-day understanding of courtroom justice and interpret any New Testament reference to justice predominantly in legal terms, quid pro quo payback justice, retributive justice, legal justice, and justice that primarily involves an imposed, painful penalty and a punishment that fits the crime. The beauty of the Bible is that it is internally consistent on the subject. We can use both testaments to define and explain God's justice. Notice that Jesus' repeated rebuke to the Pharisees was that even though they were religious outwardly, they were not merciful and kind to the outcasts of society. How terrible for you, teachers of the law and Pharisees! You hypocrites! You give to God 1/10 even of the seasoning herbs, such as mint and dill, but you neglect to obey the really important teachings of the law, such as justice and mercy and honesty. these you should practice without neglecting the others. Here we see that the New Testament definition of justice is the exact same concept we saw in the Old. You are dealing unjustly with others. Why don't you practice mercy and compassion to those around you? That is what God is really after. God would much rather have you treat others with love than to spend so much time tithing your herbs and spices. As we return to the story of the woman caught in adultery, who was unjust in that story? Was it not the self-righteous religious leaders who entrapped her as a test for Jesus? Unjust people hypocritically sat as judges and as moral authority over this poor woman who was to be stoned to death. Jesus, on the other hand, administered God's restorative justice and mercy by defending and protecting the person who was being abused and mistreated. Jesus' concept of justice calls us to love and defend the victims of our society, such as this woman. Even his call for repentance, "Go and sin no more," was uttered with kindness and was designed to motivate this woman to a way of living that was not self-destructive. This is the kind of justice the Messiah came to bring, as described prophetically in the book of Isaiah and quoted here in Matthew 12. "Here is my servant whom I have chosen, the one I love, in whom I delight. I will put my spirit on him, and he will proclaim justice to the nations. He will not quarrel or cry out. No one will hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not snuff out, till he leads justice to victory." Jesus came to bring real justice by healing the sick, the blind, and the deaf. In the person of Jesus, God's justice came to make things right by eating with sinners and tax collectors. God's justice fed 5,000 hungry people. God's justice said to the common people who had been oppressed by a group of tyrannical and arrogant religious leaders, "Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth." Unfortunately, this kind of justice was not at all what the people of the day were hoping for in their Messiah. They wanted a conquering hero who would punish their enemies. They despised his compassionate treatment of lepers and were angered by his acts of mercy, such as healing a poor man with a withered hand on the Sabbath. They despised the riffraff of society with whom Jesus ate and associated. They refused to acknowledge a king who chose a group of fishermen to be his disciples. They despised the kind of justice that Jesus came to bring, so they nailed him to a cross. The cross. Who exhibited violence and injustice at the cross? At the cross, we see no violence, no punishment coming directly from the hand of God. Who was it that exhibited violence at the cross? What we see at the cross is humanity represented by a mob of religious yet violent murderers torturing the Son of God to death. By our understanding of justice, would not the innocent Jesus have been justified to call down fire from heaven on the guilty people who brought him to a sham trial and then cruelly mocked him? Instead, what we see at the cross is the innocent Son of God saying, "Father, forgive them." This returning of love and kindness in the face of our hatred is the radical restorative justice of God. At the cross, our desire for punishment, our violence, and our hatred were replaced by God's forgiveness, God's nonviolence, and God's love. God's justice is restorative and healing, not retributive. While retributive justice seeks to fit the punishment to the crime, attempting to control wrongdoing through punishment, restorative justice forgives the crime and seeks to redeem wrongdoing through a repairing of the relationship. At the cross, We see God turning away the opportunity to exact retributive justice and the demand for retribution. And instead, God would choose to forgive. At the cross, we come face to face with the shameful depravity of our own sin. By coming face to face with the one who has the right and the power to punish, but who instead loves and forgives. In the face of human hatred and hardness of heart, God still managed to redeem. Returning violence and hatred with forgiveness and love does not often fit into our paradigm of justice, but thankfully, our God is much bigger and much better than we can possibly imagine him to be. At the cross, we see the union of love and justice, but not in the way it is usually understood. The cross was the outpouring of God's love as an act of restorative, making things right justice, not punitive or retributive justice. Love is not in conflict with justice. Love is how justice comes about. Because the New Testament understanding of justice is ultimately not about punishment, but about making things right again.